Now, the whole business of a will. We're at page 29. There is stewardship in life and there is stewardship in death. I rewrite my will every year, and along with the will, write a letter of instruction to my wife. I didn't get it in the materials, but I'll have it for you here. I'm going to put it on now so you can kind of begin copying as we talk. Connection with making a will, and we'll talk about the benefits of it and how to do it, it's also important to leave with your wives or husbands certain information which implements some of the problems that happen upon death. And here's a list of the major items that I think should be included in the contents of a letter of instruction to your wife. And every year, for example, I have many obligations, many investments, and so on, and I say, if I die this year, pay this off, get rid of this, tell the broker to do this, contact this accountant. I give various information, as well as consistently, basically, either being sure she knows this because she has some involvement with it, or by listing it for her. Some of these things, and of course you have to always be concerned what happens in the case of a co-disaster. Then you can't count on your wife because she's not going to be around either. Then what does the court-appointed guardian or whatever it is, what happens and what do they do? And so you have to give certain information. And this is the information. In fact, is while you're writing, I'll just make a comment or two. The names of people to call first in the event of death. Location of family papers, safety deposit box, of course, if you have one. A list of savings and checking accounts, a list of income tax data on previous returns. There ought to be a place for this stuff. A list of insurance policy and the locations of those policies if there are strays. The information on the family vehicles and locations of titles. Social Security data. Funeral plans, of course, have to be if you have specific ideas. I specifically have told my wife the way I want this sort of thing handled. My own conviction is against gaudy funerals, although I've left discretion with my wife because I really don't care that much. Although I have a feeling of how I'm going to do it if my wife died before me concerning no showing of the body whatsoever, and only a memorial service. But the one that needs to be comforted at that point is my wife, not me. And therefore, although I tell her my preference, I'm not going to worry too much about it. Name and addresses of doctors, location of the safe deposit box and key, location of house and real estate documents, data on loans and investments, brokerages, and so on. A list of credit cards, which of course is also a good thing to have at all times in case of loss. You'll lose your billfold, as you know. You should send a certified letter to all the credit card companies in order to limit your liability. Well, that's true, yeah. That's right. Those of you that went to the Gossard seminar, you burned all of them. Although this is really not valid. I think it's wrong to use credit cards in order to get a line of credit, but they're beautiful for income tax purposes. And I have two of my billfolds, Bank of America, and what's the other one? No, I use another one. The red one? MasterCharge, which you can use almost any place. Obviously, American Express charges you $15 now, and I quit them a couple of years ago. But I have these other two, and all my business expenses, primarily car and so on, and entertainment, I charge it all, but when the bill comes in, it's paid immediately. And my wife, for convenience, has 7 charge accounts. But when the bills come in, they never get a cent in interest out of us. They just loan us some money for a month free of interest. And I think if it's in your budget, and it's planned for, and it's merely a bookkeeping device and so on, credit cards are real great, and I recommend them. But if you can't control yourself, and you have to then begin paying their service charge and interest of 18%, then you're in trouble, as we'll see this afternoon. Details on employers, survivors, benefit plans, number 14, and finally, the personal wishes on distribution of personal effects with sentimental value. I read about an old lady who wanted all her objects, family heirlooms, in her home until she died, but she took little pieces of paper, like price tags in stores, and at the bottom of all the cups of china, all this, she put the initials of what relative she wanted these things to go to. I mentioned my father died. Boy, I didn't think I'd ever see the day, but there was a family hassle about some junk my dad owned. And I was really, didn't particularly involve my wife and myself, but some of the other members of the family. I made my mind then, boy, it's very important to write it out. Where does mother's ring go? Where does this watch go? Where does this piece of china go and all that? Because obviously it doesn't have any resale or anything like that, and the family members and the grandchildren all want something. But in our family, unfortunately, in one element, there was a big hassle and big to-do, and a couple of people aren't talking because they got something I wanted, and I put my name in first, and all that garbage. And so you want to obviate this kind of a thing by ahead of time. And the best thing to do is learn to, when you're 75, why not give, before you die, give the grandchildren each one of the family heirlooms or trinkets or what have you, while they're alive and while you're alive, and dispose of some of that stuff. But some people, they just hold on. And Dad was very good, but in this area was just a little bit, he was very unfortunate. Then he would say, this grandchild, when I die, you get this. And then you see another grandchild, when you get the same piece, and he forgot, and leads to all kinds of complications. On page 29, we have 4 major reasons for a will. Some of you say, I don't need a will, I haven't got any money, I'm a student in grad school or what have you. But there are really a couple of reasons that would include everybody. First of all, it's an opportunity to designate recipients rather than have a state do it for you. If you die intestate, that is without a will. If you don't have one, the state says, okay, half goes to your wife and half to so-and-so, and if you don't have a wife or children, then the collateral heirs, and they've got it all spelled out in the states. But you should, of course, designate. It's an opportunity. If you have children, one of the best reasons for a will is that it's an opportunity to name a guardian for the person as well as the estate of your minor children. In other words, like I have 2 brothers. I really feel one brother would make a better father for my children, although they're beginning to grow up. The youngest is 9 now. But there's one who I really feel would be better than the other. Well, I don't want any hassle, so I specify it in the will. So-and-so is to be guarding my children. Maybe you feel both the sets of grandparents are really too old, and you'd rather have somebody else, or you'd like one set of grandparents who you really feel will be more likely to raise the kids in the admonition of a ward or what have you. This gives you a chance to name that guardian of the person of the kids. And C, an opportunity to choose your executor and save the cost of a surety bond. In a small estate, and obviously a $50,000 estate isn't that big today with insurance and Social Security and investments and retirement plans and all the rest of it, and surety bonds, if you don't name an executor, in what I call a small estate, $50,000, could be $800. And a will costs you $20 or $25 or today nothing if you listen carefully. And D, to reduce state and federal death taxes. And so sometimes special care can be taken, and certainly included in A would be you might want a certain portion to the Lord's work. And I have determined what I want my wife and children to have, and the rest I want to go to the Lord's work. I'm not leaving all to my wife and hope that she will, type of a deal. I make provision now. Okay, now the actual form of a will. Do we have any lawyers here? I don't want to offend them. I'm not giving you legal advice. Not you, I mean the rest of you. I'm just suggesting that in the last 300 wills I've prepared, 98% of them prepared by my secretary, who has not had a legal education. And that 98% of them were minor variations of this will. And all I do is meet, get the information, make a couple pencil changes, hand to my secretary, and she bangs it out and mails it out and sends them a bill. And in other words, for many of us who want to leave it all to our wife and then our kids and then our, and we spell it out, it's really very simple. Now, if you have a substantial estate, or if you have a special problem, yes, seek adequate legal counsel. But for many of you, use this. And certainly this is better than the nothing that you got. Now, so I'm not trying to take business from the Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska lawyers or anything like this, but at least it will also give you some insight concerning these matters. And all you have to do is fill this in the accordance with what we're talking, type it out, and then sign it as I indicated, and you got yourself a legitimate legal will, which will go on until you tear it up. So the first paragraph is to pay expenses, which happens anyhow, and then most of us leave everything. I give and devise and bequeath unto my wife all my property and everything. Paragraph 3. But in the event that my wife, Marjorie, should predecease me, all my property I give to my kids in equal portions, those that survive me. The fourth, in the event that my, and children should all predecease me. So all I have to do is change husband and wife, but somehow this got both a husband and a half a wife will. This is in the event that my wife and children should predecease me, the husband's will. I give everything as follows. A percentage or a dollar amount to my favorite charity or charities. And then 50% of what's left to Joe Brown and Mary Smith, or my mother-in-law and father-in-law, or what have you. And you spell out. Initially, most of you want to leave everything to your wife and kids. But if they say it was a family tragedy and all five of you go, if you have three children, then you probably want to leave it some to the Lord's work, and either in dollars or percentages, and then the rest in some kind of percentage of the residue fashion to certain relatives or friends or what have you. The fifth paragraph is, for the purpose of this will, a person shall not be, and this is just a co-disaster clause, that one person is not considered to survive the other person if he dies within 60 days. So if my wife and I have an accident, and I die tomorrow, and she dies 3 weeks later, then you don't have a problem of double taxation of going all through her through my estate into her estate again, and this is what we call a co-disaster clause. The sixth is just a technical clause in order to facilitate the executor doing the business. To sell. Yes, in item six, the last word in the first line ought to be sell. Yeah, thanks a lot. I got to change both of those in my copy as well. Everybody have those two changes? In the fourth paragraph, at first, husband ought to be a wife. And in the sixth paragraph, first line, the last word should be sell. It allows the executor to sell the junk off without going through all kinds of hassles. And it's just an expediting clause. Then the seventh is, yes. Yeah, pre-deceased. Boy. Wow. In the third paragraph, first pre-deceased should be pre-deceased. This is probably why I'm not a lawyer anymore. You know why I'm not a lawyer anymore? Real fast story. In 1962, I had four full-time jobs. I had a full-time law practice. I had a full-time construction company. I was full-time at Wheaton College, and I was full-time at the Lord's work. I really was. I didn't spend too much time at home. But boy, was I busy for the Lord. And then I found time to take a fishing trip up to Canada. And the first day we were up there, we had agreed we would meet the other boat at the foot of a waterfall. There were some big rocks alongside of a waterfall, and we were going to meet there for shore lunch. And while the Indian guy was cleaning the fish, we arrived there about 10 minutes to 12, my partner decided to get up on a big rock at the top of the waterfalls and cast into the bottom of the falls, and every other cast, he got a 3-pound northern, was having a lot of fun. I decided to take a walk back along the rapids. I slipped on some moss and went right into the rapids and was carried a couple hundred yards underwater right toward the waterfall. And though a reasonably good swimmer, I couldn't do a thing. It just whoosh, like this. I said, I'll see you, Lord. And I figured it was all over. And suddenly, I felt something happen. And I had a rock in this hand and a rock in this hand, and my feet were ledged in a crevice. I opened my eyes, and there I was at the top of the waterfall. Well, actually, I was about like this. And I was like this. Here's the waterfall. You're the waterfall. And let me get over here. You're the waterfall. And I opened my eyes, and here's this surging water over my chest. I'm kind of like an astronaut sitting there, you know, how they sit. And I thought, what am I doing here? I'm in the middle of this 100-yard-wide waterfall with a 25-foot drop, and I'm right in the edge of it. And I see my man, superintendent of construction. I said, Dell! And he was over there, and he just, what are you doing out there? And, of course, it was real noisy and all that. And so he yelled to the Indian guide, and they ran, got down to the boat, and they motored around to the bottom of the falls. And the Indian guide found dry rocks leading up that waterfall right to where I was. And he grabbed me. I climbed down the rocks with him. And we went by there the next day, and there had been no rain, and it was a solid waterfall. What does that tell you? Boy, oh boy, what are you saying? And I knew he was saying something, and then the word availability became a key word in my life. And I, within 3 months, I contacted all my clients and said, I am no longer in business. I contacted Wheaton College, went halftime the following year to give them a chance to get somebody, and I left the following year. I stopped all construction except a couple of jobs that I was doing, that I was in the midst of, and I was committed to. And I sent notices to all the boards I was on, about 15 of them, and I said, when the term is over, I'm through. And that was the beginning of four experiences. I mentioned yesterday I had four experiences. I almost died. That was the first one. It's something to do with the will. I don't know how I got on this story, but So obviously, if you die, husband, your wife automatically, of course, is guardian of children. Heaven says, in the event my wife does not survive me, say a co-disaster or she's incompetent or whatever happens, I hereby appoint so-and-so. And this is that provision for guardianship which I mentioned earlier. And then the last paragraph is that provision to have your wife executor or somebody else. Now you make up two wills, couples, one for you and one for your wife. And wherever it says wife, you put husband in the wife's will. And the one we're talking about is a husband's will. Then it's important, of course, that it be signed properly. That word seal is where the signature of the husband goes, or wife, the wife will. And then you have it signed in the presence of three witnesses. Most states only require two witnesses, but some states require three witnesses. So nobody requires more than that. And therefore, you're best to have three witnesses. It also gives you an extra chance to get another witness to prove up the will in the case one moves away or is too old or dies or what happens. Your best, since amazing part is, you can make up a will and you might find that 7 years later you never looked at it and people have moved away and so on. It's best to have people who own homes in the community who are about your age or younger and who will be around. Or if you have three friends who are going to the far corners of the earth to be service missionaries, don't use them as your witnesses, because they're not going to contact Afghanistan for you and Tanganyika in order to prove up your will. And so you're best to have people that are going to probably be around. All right, that's just a fast go-over. And if any of you during the lunch hour want to go ahead and fill yours in and then come back and you have a question or two, we'll be happy to answer questions. Now, do you have any questions now for a few minutes? Yes. In a safe place. And, of course, the answer is safe deposit box at $3.30 or $4.40 a month, a year, if you have one. If you don't, where do you keep the rest of your junk? Put it there. No. No, it's not. The word seal is a historical thing, and it makes the whole thing professional. But like states like Illinois, you no longer have to have the word. In the old days, you see, you put your mark and you had your ring and you put the seal on a piece of pressed wax and that really made it legal. Today, this has no significance. And although frequently you still put it there because of historicity, but it really means nothing. You just signed your name. And no, you do not need a notary seal in any state. And you need not type it. And it need not be in your handwriting. It's only important that you sign it in the presence of all three witnesses, and all three witnesses sign in the presence of each other and you. The four of you have to all be together. That's the specific questions that are asked by the judge to prove the will. Where were you? Who else was there? And that's the questions asked the witness, and that's how they prove up a will. Yeah, I don't think that, yes, you'll only use a trustee if you have an estate substantially in excess of $100,000. And then if it's in excess of $300,000, you ought to have a corporate trustee, a bank. When you start moving to those levels, I suggest you invest a couple of bucks and you get legal help on it. Because a trustee complicates the situation. Surprising how few really need it, though. Now, I do make provision for the guardian of the state of minor children, which is kind of a trustee situation. But, of course, if you don't really think your wife is capable of doing it, of course, then, and you have substantial sums, of course, then you want a trustee. I would seek help on that, though. Right. Well, the third party in that particular case is the guardian in the seventh. You appoint so-and-so, your brother, as guardian of the estate, that's the money, and the person, that's the possession of the kids. Yeah, they get both in, but they have to account for them separately to the court. Yes. Now, one caution here. In most states, the guardian of the estate and the executor must be a resident of the state. I don't know what the rule is in Nebraska and Kansas, but in Illinois, I have to pick out somebody who is a resident of the state of Illinois to be the executor, if my wife can't be it, and the guardian of the estate or the money of my minor children. But I can appoint my twin brother in California to be guardian of the person of my children. But I got to appoint my brother in Oak Brook, Illinois, to be the guardian of the estate, the money. It's a requirement in most states, so you gotta be careful who you appoint. You can't appoint your mother and father to be the guardian of the estate of your minor children if those parents are in New York. So you gotta be careful, you know, your state law in that regard. But the safe place is to be sure to use somebody in your state, then you know you're safe.
In some states, Texas does have a strong freedom to go to people not passing on all these people through the chief fire and then they're going to start moving the call.
I'm not aware of that. Well, they do everything different. In law school, we had the national rule, but the Texas minority rule in almost everything. So that makes sense. Yes. It's preferable to make only an original. Otherwise, you get the problem with this copy before and after, and why wasn't it dated, and all that stuff. And then your best bet is don't ask anybody whether they'll be an executor or the guardian of the state or the guardian of the person. This gets everybody all upset. And they say, well, boy, can I do that? And all this kind of stuff. These positions are very perfunctory. Let's face it, the lawyers do the work. They say, sign here, sign here, sign here. And normally, you know, it doesn't really require any great know-how or anything. And when I tell my people, don't even ask your parents or the in-laws whether or not if you both get killed, they'll take care of the five kids. We take care of five. If you both get killed, they'll take care of them. Don't worry about it. You know, but don't ask them because, for example, the statistics are that only 1 in 5,000 die in a co-disaster. Well, that's not very many. And therefore, you can't get too fancy. Some people come to me and they want to, you know, make a will this long. You know, what if this happens and if this organization goes defunct and, you know, you're better to look at it more often and keep it a little simpler.
Yes. How often do you recommend an ordinary person to change their way? You said you did yours annually.
Yeah, well, I do it more on the basis of the letters of instruction when I give her specific information, which loans to pay off, what to sell and buy, and some basic instructions for those who follow, so they can follow some of my tracks of what I've been doing that year. But normally, obviously, it wouldn't have to be that often. Now, the will, I also changed because through the years, some organizations, for example, that I really saw fit to support, I no longer see fit. Using some of the principles I gave you, I don't see them in that context. I don't see, for example, the hand of the power of the Spirit of God on some of them like I'd like to, and so on. And so some that I have given vast sums to, I wouldn't give a penny to today. I don't have any misgivings. That's where I was at that particular point. But I've had substantial change of heart in things. And so when you have that change, then you've got to make things conform. I mean, as to whether or not giving to something that's blessed the Lord, whether it'll bless me. Of course, it's always a blessing to know that you're doing things according to His will, so that when I see certain things that I mentioned in the giving happen as I analyze the response after a gift. Well, yes, it's exciting, for example, to apparently tie in with the timing of God and the will of God. To that extent, it's a blessing, yes. And obviously, I expect people that follow God's principles to be blessed. And we tend to use the Institute frequently as an illustration. Well, God's blessing the Institute, and well, they're blessed, I'm blessed, and it's kind of a mutual, reciprocal thing, yes. Would you care to spend, we have 15 minutes here, this went a little faster than I thought, covering a little bit of the material from yesterday. On page 19, 20, and 21, did most of you get to read that problem? I received this in the mail from a widow in California. And she apparently was a sensitive person, and she owned a piece of rental property. And she was using it for income in her retirement. And at one, and she had a small 5.5% mortgage on that property. At that point, the mortgages were going at pretty much 8.5% and 9% in California during the credit crunch of 1969 and 70. And her daughter got married, and she decided to sell the house to her daughter and son-in-law at a fair figure, and held a new 8.5% second mortgage, because instead of getting rental, she was then going to receive this income in the form of interest from her daughter and son-in-law. But then she came across a verse in the King James, Psalm 15:5, that says, "He that putteth not out his money to usury." I was on page 16, if you want to look for just 1 second, we have Psalm 15, page 16. And in this description of the citizen of Zion, a righteous man, he's the kind of a guy, verse 5, who does not put out his money at usury, the King James says. Now here it says, does not put out his money at interest. That even sounds worse. So she was very distraught. She said, am I wrong in charging them interest? Am I charging too much? I'm paying 5.5% on the small first mortgage, but I'm charging them 8.5% on the second mortgage. What should I do? And this prompted me to look into this whole area of investments versus loans to relatives and friends and so on. And first of all, I extracted some of the Old Testament laws. First of all, that loans were to be interest-free to fellow Jews. And there's a verse in Exodus there. One says, if you lend to my people, so therefore the implication is that you can, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him, you shall not charge him interest. And if you're not to act as a creditor, you are also then not to act to the point where you'll foreclose on him or demand your money back. And yet there still can be an understanding when you can pay it back in kind of a real loose loan situation. Well, the first thing to understand is that usury in the King James does mean just plain old interest, not usury as we understand it legally. Usury legally is an illegal rate of interest. For example, in Illinois, we have an 8% legal rate of interest. And if you charge me 9%, I can get out of paying you the interest, maybe even get out of paying you the principal, unless it's a business loan or it's to a corporation. There are exceptions, like small business loans, which can go up into 36% a year, 3% a month. But basically, usury is an illegal rate of interest. Number two, interest could be charged to foreigners. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen, you may not charge interest. Three, A lender should not hold security which is essential to the well-being of the borrower. Number four, lenders were to forgive the debts of countrymen every seventh year. Every good law we have today has its foundation, in its foundation, the scripture. Today, we have a statute of limitations where if I borrow $1,000 from you, and if I make no payment to you in 7 years, and it's not somehow reestablished as a liability, in 7 years and one day I can say, ha 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 ha, I don't owe you $1,000 anymore, and there's nothing you can do legally about it. And so this is the same way as a mortgage. If a mortgage, after 20 years, if no payments have been made and something else is done, a mortgage becomes invalid and no longer is an obligation. And the difference then apparently was it was a set time, as we'll see. Number five, loans are to be made based on need, irrespective of risk of not payment. You shall generously lend him sufficient for his need. Beware lest there's a base thought in your heart saying, oh boy, we're getting close to the seventh year, the year of remission, and so you put him off. You say, boy, in a year, it's the seventh year, and you won't get pay me. See me in about a year and a couple days. So at least I get 7 years. I was at the, if a guy needs it, give it to him then, no matter what. This was to the Jew. Number six, borrowing should be limited. We read that this morning. Number seven, to co-sign with another or pledge assets for another is seldom wise. I think Bill kind of stresses that you should never do it, but there's a verse, for example, in Proverbs 22:26 that indicates that it can be done on occasion if you can afford it. For example, I co-signed a loan with my son-in-law. Well, to me, this is an investment in his education. I told him, Greg, if we goof and if we lose it, there's your education. Big, costly a little bit, but so we lost $25,000. So I think it makes a difference as to whether or not you can afford it. And you got to count the cost. If he's going to lose it, you're going to be bitter against the rest of your life. Then don't co-sign and hurry back and try to get the lender to scratch your name off if you can, the proverb says. Then, as usual, Jesus comes along, and that's not bad enough. He broadens it. But I say unto you, which we were talking about this morning, charge no interest and anticipate no repayment if the loan is based on a basic need. Let us do good unto all men, and especially those of the household of faith. And do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, even though you lend it, and even though you might get it back. For he himself is kind and ungrateful to ungrateful and evil men. And then this next paragraph, which kind of sums it up, God's economy demands that we approach lending contrary to the world's thinking. The greater the need and risk, the more we try to make the loan. The less interest we charge, the less security demand, and the less effort we make to obtain repayment. Very extraordinary. Yes. We're coming to that next page. Deny a loan only when denial is in the borrower's best interest. And we talked about that. I'll be ready to stand ready to listen to all requests. But this whole business of if you believe in the principle of fiscal breathing, help other than a gift or loan is frequently advisable. Are you as willing to give of yourself as this money? And then the third one, the charging of interest on investments is proper. In one of the parables, Jesus said, then why did you not put the money in the bank, and having come, I would have collected with interest? And there's nothing wrong. But remember, what starts as an interest can become a loan for need, subject to different considerations. Remember the principle of 100% ownership by God and 100% stewardship by us, along with the principles of yielding personal rights. A recognition of these principles enables us to be taken without bitterness, without concern. And then the verse in Corinthians, that it's better to be defrauded and wronged than to sue your brother. And so my advice to the widow was, you've done it now, it's fair, it's proper to charge the interest you're charging, but if your son-in-law suddenly goes blind or comes incapacitated, even though you might be losing your investment, you must not foreclose the mortgage. You must be willing to forget the interest and mortgage payments if he can't make it, because you have entered into a situation, in this case, with a brother and sister in Christ, even though it happens to be a relative. And so you should remember that this can happen. And therefore, if you can't afford it to happen, then don't make that kind of an investment even to a family member. Any questions in this area? Go ahead. Page 14. Right.
On the number 3 there, the second scripture, Ecclesiastes 5:19.
Right.
Would you accept that and give your opinion on that?
Yeah. We already can't get into the stock market area, but we'll just cover this one point. One of the symptoms of a financial obsession is inability to give or spend freely. And then this verse is one of the indications whether or not that which you have in the way of wealth came from the Lord or not. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, this young lady asked me before, if some people improperly use money, does that mean that it came from the devil rather than from the Lord? Not necessarily. But when it comes from the Lord, it might be come from the fact that he's just followed good principles, even though he's all wet in other principles as far as God is concerned. He has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. And I use as an illustration John D. Rockefeller, who at age 70 said, I would give half of my millions if I could have one square meal and not get sick to my stomach. Remember, all he could do is give dimes away and drink milk. All the concerns had done something to his stomach, and that was his statement. And my guess from that statement is that God did not give him his riches and wealth. I think he used some good, sound business judgment, and he used some ruthless tactics in those days of Standard Oil, and so he made his millions. But God will be the ultimate judge of that. But you can, those of you that have some riches and wealth, you want to say, are you really enjoying them? Does it take you to Hawaii? Fine. Do you really enjoy Hawaii, or do you fight with your wife when you get there? You know, can you really enjoy the seashore with her? And do you enjoy work? Well, I think God has empowered me to get riches and wealth, because I enjoy everything that I do. I love playing, I love work. I love to be with my kids, and I love to be with other people. I love to dig in at the office, and I love to be away from the office. And I think this is one of the verses that gives you some indication as to where your wealth is coming from, whether it really comes from God and really is a blessing imposed by Him, or whether it's just a result of something else.
Second on page 19 under 2, the interest will be called foreigners, if you define foreigners.
Yeah, I think following the same train, I think it's a question either they're in the kingdom or they are not in the kingdom, and I think we should give preferential treatment to our brothers in the kingdom. And I think that, I doubt if New Testament-wise there is this distinction. I think that there will be a kind of a preference and a leaning over. And I think the Spirit of God will have you lean more over to brothers than those who are not in the kingdom. But I think this will be the same test. If it's on the basis of a need, I mean a real need, a brother came to me and said, I need $4,000. He was in the real estate business. And he could have gotten the savings and loan, but they were hassling him, and it was a time problem and so on. And in this case, he could have done it another way, but in a way, I see it, saw it as a need. And I said, Bill, what is the amount? $4,000. I wrote him out a check and I said, here's the $4,000. Do you intend to pay it back? Oh, you bet I intend to pay you back. I intend to pay you interest. I said, well, you do what you want to do. What do you anticipate doing? I intend to pay you back in 3 months. And I'll pay you 1% interest. I said, well, I'm not charging you anything, and I'm not going to look for it in 3 months. But you are making a commitment, which I think is wise. He paid me a year and a half later, but he never received a phone call from me. I said, I will never call you. As far as I'm concerned, I have given it to you on an indefinite basis. If you want to pay it back, please loan, fine. I see it as a need now, and in a sense, I see it. I told him these principles of, in a way, I see it as an investment. I see it as an equity of $100,000, so it's hardly a need. Yet, in one sense, at that point, it was a need for him. I said, but I still will not expect it back. And you don't have to walk to the other side of the street if you haven't paid me. I'll know there's a reason why, and I'll expect you to be fair and do what's right for your own good. And this is exactly what happened. And he finally did pay, and he did pay 1% a month. He sent a check, and that was it. And I said, thank you.
I gather from what you're saying was that charge interest on investment is profit.
Yes.
And yet loans were to be interest-free to fellow Christians. What is your line of determining what you're
Well, I think, for example, say if a brother has a home and he has an overdue mortgage payment, and he says, I've got to pay this on time because they have a late payment fee or they're ready to file a foreclosure and so on, I would be more inclined to give the money. I had a closing about 4 months ago, a rather poor family, very, very unwise, and that's probably why they're poor, but they said, would you handle the closing? And, of course, they weren't going to pay me. It was going to be a friendship deal. But I said, I'd be happy to do it. They had gone to a small loan company to borrow $2,000 as a down payment on a $16,000 home. You know, height of stupidity. But they had done it, and I handled the closing for them. At the closing, they learned that in about 5 days, their first mortgage payment was due. On the way out, they said, can we borrow $175 to make the first mortgage payment, and we'll try to pay you back? I went, thought about it, and I said, well, I will not loan it to you. First of all, I think you're very wise, unwise in the way you've done this thing. Now that I find out you won't go to a small loan company and are paying 24% interest on the down payment, you'll never come out of this thing, but I wish you the best. And I wrote my check, $175, and I said, this is your first housewarming gift. But I didn't even think of that being an investment. And I said, this is a gift. I didn't even want to put them in that bondage. You know, you see them at church, and they only want to look at you and all this stuff, you know. So to me, that was a need. And he's a brother. I just gave it to him. And so that was the fee I charged in that particular case. No. I think if a couple of them do, it just might be the more expedient thing to do, but a will can be proved up with no witnesses. If it's proved they're all dead, they're bringing signatures from their bank accounts and so on, it's still in yours, and it can be proved up even if they're all gone, but it just makes a bigger hassle out of it. Well, I'm not sure, you know, specifically where it says that, but it just seems to me our aim ought to be to try to encourage everybody's freedom, including our own. And you really put a person in bondage when you buttonhole them. You said that. They know what they think about it more than you do, probably. And here's where we must be merciful so that we may receive mercy. And but so I still, you want to remember that this investment can turn in to a gift for need if a need develops, and you got to be ready to yield your rights in those instances. And of course, always lean in favor of the other guy. I have about 250 apartments, and I have not gone to court in 12 years. back there, I went, I say, three times in the first 8 years. But I just write them all off. I will take nobody to court. I had one illustration here in the ethics part. The Flynn family. A wife, divorced, with five children. The biggest pig I have ever seen. I go in that apartment, and it was an absolute shambles. And they were wrecking the whole apartment building. She was about $800 delinquent. And I finally, for the benefit of the other tenants, I had to get rid of her. I didn't want to because she was definitely poor, and I did not want to reproach God. I could not evict her. I said, Mrs. Flynn, have I been fair with you? I appealed to her conscience. Yes. Will you be fair with me? Yes. If I find you a place to live, will you move? Yes. I said, go find a place. She found a place. It was $220 a month and a $220 surety deposit. I gave her a check for $440. And I said, okay, the agreement is then that you'll take this and you'll move in that apartment. I don't know how Christian I was being to the new landlord, but that's another question. I gave her the $440. And I said, and I will forgive the $800. You've got to promise to go the first of the month. Fine. She went to sign up the lease, and they said, you haven't got good enough credit. We want 2 months in advance at $660. She said, Mr. Wolfman, I need another $220 if I'm going to move. I said, okay, another $220. And then we were all set, and then she called me. She said, I can't move. Why can't you move? I don't have a refrigerator. I said, I'll deliver a refrigerator. So I delivered a refrigerator for the new apartment, and I furnished her a truck, and we moved her. I said, that's ridiculous. No, it isn't. I sleep like a log. And I find that when I do this, which is turning another cheek, and it's kind of lousy in some ways, you know, when people hand this way, God comes through every time. I mean, not only in that spiritual blessing, materially, I mean, things happen. And the timing of the things, God's saying, I am debtor to no man. You did what was right, but you'll always get it back. And that's what's happened. And this is that story of the more I shovel it in, the more God shovels back because he's got a bigger shovel.